Echoes from the Riffs podcast, January 1st, 2008. Hello, and welcome to the year 2008 and the first episode of the Echoes from the Riffs podcast. My name is Chris Perrin, and I will be your guide into the world of Palladium books. You know, I'd hoped that the start of the year would be a time for celebration, but it's with a heavy heart that I have to record this episode. One of the Palladium family, Eric Wujek, has been stricken with an illness. Eric wrote such games as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Ninjas and Super Spies, and Mystic China, as well as having his influence in a whole lot of other works. Unfortunately, he went to the doctor because he thought he had the flu and found out that he had pancreatic cancer, which has moved into his liver. Eric wrote a lot of games that meant a lot to me personally, and I was able to tell him that when I did this interview that you're going to get to hear. Now, if you'd like to tell Eric what he meant to you, there's a site you can go to put up by Kevin and others whose lives Eric has touched. You can go to ericwujek.com, which is ericwujek.com. You can go there, sign up for an account, and leave a comment telling Eric and others just what Eric and his books have meant to you. If you get the chance, I highly recommend you do so. But until then, sit back, relax, and listen to this, the first part of a 2-episode series of conversations I had with Eric Wujek about life, game design, and the early days of the Detroit Gaming Center. Welcome back to the Echoes from the Riffs podcast. This is Chris, and I'm here with Eric Wujek. And
good to be here.
Thanks. Good to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Because the podcast has to do with Riffs and Palladium, it's important to say that I'm a guy who was raised in Detroit, Michigan, and spent a lot of time there, most of my early life in Detroit. And because I was in Detroit and hanging out at Wayne State University, that's where I got to know Kevin Ciambieta. That kind of led to, we had an organization there called the Wayne Weir Gamers, this oddball little role-playing group, and that led to us getting together and doing a lot of gaming stuff together, and that in turn led to Palladium Books.
What Palladium Books have you worked on?
I was there at the very beginning. Kevin and I talked a lot about his game system. I was running something called the Detroit Gaming Center, and Kevin was I was sort of the director, and he was the associate director of the Detroit Gaming Center. And one of the anchors of the Detroit Gaming Center was Kevin's Saturday Night Game, his Palladium of Desires game. And this is something that we talked about a lot, you know, when it was going on. And we used to talk about system stuff, and we used to talk about, you know, a lot about game, you know, mechanics and role-playing and all that kind of stuff. And when he wanted to start a game company, his first thing that he wanted to do was he wanted to publish Palladium Fantasy, the game that we all know now. But he just didn't have enough money, he didn't have enough resources to do that, so he came up with this idea of doing the Mechanoids. And the first book was The Mechanoid Invasion. And I contributed a little chunk of that. I mean, the little scenario oddball stuff at the end of Mechanoid Invasion was one of the first role-playing things that I wrote for publication. So I was really there and had, you know, little bits and pieces in just about everything he did, including the first Weapons and Castles book. I did one of the maps for it. I helped him with a book called Weapons and Assassins. So, you know, I was kind of helping out when, you know, as early as the company got started.
I'm not sure everyone's familiar with the Detroit Gaming Center. Can you give us an overview of exactly what that was?
Sure. So what happened was we were running this club at Wayne State University. And it was just growing. We kept booking rooms at the student center, and we just kept needing more rooms and more space, and we kept having more game masters. It was really booming. And eventually there was a small house on campus run by one of the colleges, Monteith College. And there were rooms in that house, and it was moving towards a situation where they were going to demolish the house. So we managed to get the whole house. So for about a year, the Wayne Ware Gamers had this entire house to run games in. And it was it wasn't the greatest place in the world, but it was free. And we ended up running just about every night of the week. And as I said before, Kevin was sort of an anchor to that since he ran this huge Saturday night game. And he and I and some other people got together, and we realized that this house wasn't going to last forever, that the university was going to tear it down eventually. So we decided to start this thing called the Detroit Gaming Center. And what we did is we went out and found a place near campus, just a couple blocks from campus, where we could open up a full-time gaming center, a place where people could play games all the time. And we had a sort of transition place, and then we happened into this place that was owned by the Kresge Foundation, who weren't really interested in making money on it. They just wanted to see occupants there. It was 6,000 square feet. We had 16 rooms for gaming. And we could afford, you know, if our membership could stay up, we could afford to keep this thing going 24 hours, 7 days a week, and that's what we did. Kevin and I, for a couple of years, managed to keep this Detroit Gaming Center together, and out of that came an awful lot of games. A lot of game masters, a lot of games, a lot of people learned a lot about game mastering. It was one of these crazy places where there were multiple games running every night, and people were competitive as game masters. I mean, you really had to be a good game master to get enough players. So that all of us became better and better game masters, and our games got better and better as we were hanging out at the gaming center. And Kevin was undoubtedly, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the best game master I ever saw. I mean, to this day, I still say Kevin Sambieta is the best game master I've ever seen.
Wow, and so that gave birth to his massive 20, 30-person games that he always brags about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like nothing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
I mean, we're talking about you would walk in, and there would literally be 25 people playing in this game. I remember walking in one day, and there were all 25 people literally standing on their chairs, chanting, and just going absolutely berserk. I've never seen anything like it before or since. For a guy to be able to engage on a regular basis over 20 people for hours, you know, we're talking about they would start at 7, 8 o'clock in the evening and then go till dawn, and it would just be nonstop.
That's unbelievable. Every time I think about that, I couldn't do it. You know, I know we're kind of getting off the schedule I set up, but I think it's a good segue to talk about game mastering in general, and then maybe we can get back to some of the specific books you worked on.
Sure.
What kind of tips did you learn for game masters that you could share with the audience?
Well, part of it was a matter of pacing. Part of it was a matter of sort of dramatic tension that we all learned that we had to keep everybody involved in the story, and we had to keep everybody involved continuously. I mean, again, that competition thing, you know, if somebody gets left out of the story, if it's easy for them to walk down the hall and join another game, eventually you're going to lose your people. You have got to keep people, you've got to get all the players at the table involved all the time as much as possible. And part of it is just learning from other great game masters. I mean, I don't see people do this nearly enough. One of the great things that you can do as a game master is go watch other people do it. Don't assume that you know everything. Don't assume that you're the, you know, just because you got a great game and you got great players and everything is going well, don't assume that you've got nothing to learn. If you go to watch other people play, you will learn a lot. If you go to a convention and you watch the other game masters, you can learn a tremendous amount about how this whole process takes place, what you've got to do, how to engage every one of the players, how to figure out how each player can be drawn into the story. I mean, what I learned from Kevin specifically, Kevin is a guy who has an incredible intuition for building villains, for building characters that will engage each person that he's already got. So that anybody there, he'll look at the player and he'll look at their character and think, what kind of character can I introduce that will drive this person insane? not just, you know, engage them, but actually, you know, take them all the way to their limit so they would feel that the game is completely challenging. Another amazing game master was a guy by the name of Rene Vega, a great buddy of mine. And he had the ability to just make you totally lose track of the real world. I mean, you would actually believe that you were there in the environment. You know, I mean, you would just lose track of the world. His gift for verbally painting the picture of where you were in, you know, just a few little details, a few little sketches here or there, and you were there. I've talked to plenty of people who just felt like they were suddenly in his world. And that's an amazing thing. Every person that I watched as a game master helped me a little bit more figuring out how to do this properly.
You brought up two points that I wanted to follow up on. The first was using the character sheet as the communication mechanism between game master and player. Can you kind of talk how you see that working?
Well, you know, I mean, a character sheet for me is a very personal thing. You know, I've had a lot of evolution with character sheets over the years. In some games, I think a character sheet is absolutely essential, and it really helps pin the player with the character. On the other hand, I play plenty of games where I use no character sheet whatsoever, and it's not totally necessary. It's something that I think you have to figure out for yourself how it is that it's going to work with what you're doing. And you also have to figure out that, let's face it, not every player is going to have the same kind of relationship with a character sheet as every other player. For some people, the character sheet is a really important, crucial thing. For other people, they lose their character sheet all the time. It's not that big a deal. It's not that important. I mean, one of the things that I did, for example, in the, you were talking about other games that I've done, I did a game called Amber Diceless. And for the first few years of Amber Diceless, I kept the character folders for every player. And I had this huge box that I would carry around, and every player character had this huge folder with all this information that they would put in, that I would put in, that, you know, it would involve all this stuff. It would just be this binder that got bigger and bigger and bigger. And because that a lot of that game involved player contributions, it was really important to have that kind of thing. On the other hand, I've had some games in recent years where we've had no character sheets whatsoever because the story is so crystal clear and because people are so clear as to what their character is, the sheet could almost be a distraction for what they need to be focused on. You know, and that's a big question for you when you're talking about character sheets. What do you want the players to be focused on? Are they focused on a particular set of numbers and characteristics? Then you need a character sheet. Are you focused on things that are going up and down and that you've got to keep track of how these things are going up and down? Again, you need a character sheet. On the other hand, if the game master is keeping track of most of it and all you've really got to focus on is how your character is interacting with the world, sometimes you can get away without it altogether.
Very interesting. So you were talking about a friend who could really pull everyone into this immersive game world. Can you talk a little bit about some of the techniques he used to do that?
Well, it was almost magical. You know, it's hard for me to define it exactly. I mean, this is a guy who really understood the psychology of role players, understood what we were looking for, and could relatively briefly paint this visual picture so that we actually felt like we were in the place and that we could add to it on our own. We didn't feel like we had to have every single detail described to us because he was able to make everything seem come together so logically so that all the pieces started to lay themselves out. I mean, most of his games had a highly technological science fiction background, so that once we understood sort of the technological underpinnings, the understructure of the spaceships that we were in, you know, we would know what all the different corridors were, what all the power passages were, you know, where power was routed through the ship, how the systems worked. And the more we learned about how the system works, the more that we were there, as opposed to just talking about it, because we would be given the power of the engineers, for example, that we could actually change the ship and shift it around, so that instead of always going to the game master and saying, okay, so how do we do this or how do we do this, eventually certain players would become specialized, and rather than the game master telling us, he'd say, okay, well, look at Joe. Joe's the guy who runs the system. You just rerouted it last week. What did you do with it? And that guy would end up having to visualize it himself and feed it back to the other players. So that's one of the things where you can kind of involve the other players so that they start adding to the content of the game.
So it was both internally consistent, but also there was an element of interactivity in there so that all the players had buy-in. That's a really cool technique. I'm going to have to remember that one.
I think interactivity, I mean, we really have to remember that this is all about interactivity. And one of the things that I think people learned back at the old gaming center is that the game masters who tried to be authoritative, you know, what we call railroaders these days, that tried to be authoritative and tell everybody what's what and have the story all composed in advance were the ones who failed. The ones who were successful, who were the ones who were completely interactive with their players, who responded to the players' needs, who responded to the players even before the players knew what they wanted, that they were laying the dungeon or the corridor or the spaceship or the mansion or whatever it was altering and changing as the players expressed themselves, so that the outcome was determined by the players, not by the game master.
Excellent. That's really good advice. So if we can segue now back maybe into some of the games that you worked on, we kind of talked a little bit about what you did for Mechanoids and for Palladium Fantasy.
So after Mechanoids, you know, I had some little bits and pieces here and there. I mean, the whole attribute system, the basic attribute system, a lot of that was worked out when Kevin and I were folding my laundry at a laundromat near his house. I mean, I vividly remember. Yeah, I mean, we were just, you know, working out all the details and stuff, and we kept batting it back and forth. But, you know, my big involvement came when I say my big involvement, Emma was over there all the time. Kevin and I were these really close friends. You know, we were sort of living in each other's houses and going out to eat all the time. And, you know, we were good buddies. We were talking just about every day. And what happened was somebody approached him about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle license, that a guy had come to him and said, hey, this is a really cool comic book. I think this would make a really great game. Kevin agreed and showed it to me, and I agreed, and we all agreed that this would make just a dynamite role-playing game. This is at the point where Palladium Fantasy is out and Heroes Unlimited is out, and it's clear that this would make a great addition to the Palladium lineup. So we were all sitting around waiting, and everything was coming together. And unfortunately, the guy who had brought the idea to Kevin failed. I mean, he came in months late, and I don't remember the exact details, but it was three or four months behind deadline. Kevin was really backed into a corner, and he came to me and he said, Eric, can you do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in 4 weeks? And I said, whoa. Well, I'll give it a try. Although, you know, it was the biggest project I had ever tried to do on my own. I mean, in terms of doing an entire role-playing game, an entire book. And it took me 5 weeks, but we got it done.
How much did you sleep?
Well, you know, I'm known as a guy who can get by with very little sleep if I need to. So, you know, and I was working, I was doing other work and stuff. But I managed to get the project done, not in the 4 weeks that he had wanted, but in the 5 weeks he got it done. And we're all really pleased with it. And by the way, that was with time for playtesting. I mean, that whole game was playtested pretty extensively. And the original characters in the back of the book were actually from the playtesting. I couldn't publish all their characters, but the sparrows and a couple of the other characters were actually from the playtesting. But that turned out to be a really solid role-playing game, and that really got my chops in terms of figuring out what it would take to write a role-playing game from beginning to end. You know, what does it take to present this thing properly? How do you do this thing? And ever since then, you know, I've been involved in doing a fair amount of work for Kevin, depending on how much time I had and how much other stuff I'm doing. Eventually, I got to creating my own company where I did Amber Diceless role-playing, and that took up a lot of time. And then back in 98, I started working in the electronic game business where I'm still working, and that takes up an enormous amount of time and a lot of late nights. But I still love doing the Palladium games, and I still, you know, have things that I plan on doing that I'm kind of inching along, and there's a few projects that I'm still working on for Kevin, way behind deadline, but I'm still working on.
The thing that I always remembered about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was the fact you could create teams of animals, and if one of them got a bonus and the entire team got that bonus, how'd that idea come about? I've always wanted to know.
Well, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, remember, I was basing it on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and clearly, I didn't, you know, I mean, if you read the stats of the Ninja Turtles in the book, I didn't set out the rules so that you could create a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. They were meant to be a little larger than life, you know, a high level and, you know, with some extra bonuses and whatever. I didn't want people to create the game and then beat up the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles with first level characters. I didn't think that was appropriate. But when I was thinking about it, I mean, it made sense to me that if a bunch of characters grew up together, knew all their strengths and weaknesses, were brothers or characters with exactly the same background, that it made sense that they would have bonuses, that they would bounce off each other, they would learn off of each other. So the sterile characters that were in the back of the book that were based on guys from the role playing from the initial playtest, there were three characters who decided to create team characters so they could get those bonuses. And they loved that. They loved that they could all create the same kind of character and then they'd get extra bonuses out of it. It was a lot of fun and they spent, you know, and it worked out well as a role playing thing because they, you know, spent a lot of time bickering and, you know, arguing with each other and, you know, arguing with the other characters. I mean, it just was a fun role playing thing to have happen. When a bunch of guys decide to play the same character in a game like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or what's now After the Bomb, you've got a certain dynamic where nobody really wants to be exactly like everybody else. You're doing it for the bonuses, which means you're also a little irritated with everybody else because you're doing it for the bonuses. And I like the kind of dynamic that brings to the game.
Absolutely. So you then go on from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to do the revised recon. How'd that work?
Well, you know, this was something else where we got the rights, and Kevin, you know, had initially thought, as I recall, and, you know, we're going back quite a ways, but as I recall, he had thought that he would do it himself. He just ran out of time. I mean, he was taking on too much, as he still does. And, you know, when I looked at the game, I thought this was really cool. And in that game in particular, we started off, what we brought in, got from Jeff Martin, was a miniatures game. I mean, it was clearly a war game using miniatures, and we were a role-playing game company. So from my perspective, I had to figure out, how can this big thing be a role-playing game? I mean, it's great to have a miniatures game, and, you know, we're all gamers, and we love playing all kinds of different games, but we're Palladium Books, we've got to publish a role-playing game. So for me, in that particular case, it was so much involved with in the playtesting of it, where a lot of the game system came about when, you know, I got people together and I started figuring out how are we going to run these scenarios as a role-playing thing. And this whole thing about ambushes became crystal clear as I was playtesting that was much more important than a lot of other aspects. You know, I've always been interested in figuring out how to use role-playing systems that will engender good role-playing without interfering with what the players want to do. So the bonuses and liabilities that came from ambushing other teams became hypercritical to Recon. And of course, a lot of this was based on my research. I mean, this was done years ago. I had already known guys who had fought in Vietnam. I was able to talk to a lot of them about how they perceived it. I read an enormous number of books on Vietnam at the time. You know, in order to do the Recon book, I probably read another 150 books on Vietnam, you know, really tried to focus in on exactly what the warfare was like. What kind of warfare did I want to talk about? And in a war that went on for a really long time and in a lot of battlefields and in a lot of different possible things, there's no way I could cover everything. I had to cover what I thought was the quintessential Vietnam War experience. And the quintessential war experience in Vietnam is ambushing the other guy or getting ambushed. I mean, that's what it was all about. The straight-up fight was relatively rare when you break it down and you see what's going on. It's all about getting the jump on the other guy.
So then you go on to work on Ninjas and Super Spies.
So to me, Ninjas and Super Spies was just a natural. You know, I was fascinated by martial arts. I've always been fascinated by martial arts. I was a huge student of just about all things Japanese all the way through, you know, and I spent a lot of years in university where I studied a lot of Japanese history and art history and military history and, you know, knew a lot about it. And also was very keen on martial arts. I studied a couple of martial arts myself pretty tentatively, but I gotta tell you, I'm the kind of guy who every time I meet somebody who's really into martial arts, I quiz them. I ask a ton of questions. I want to know everything that they can tell me about it. And I vividly remember meeting, for example, this guy who had studied personally with Bruce Lee. You know, I spent 2 hours of this guy's time just asking him everything I could think of about, you know, about that. And so when the opportunity came along for Ninjas and Super Spies, it was just a matter of, you know, once again, digging in my heels, doing as much massive research as I could do, and doing that whole thing of figuring out the thing that always bothered me in every other role-playing game where they'd have ninjas or they'd have samurai or they'd have something. I want to know, how do we set this thing up so that if two of these characters end up in a back alley, the game master can run the thing so it can go any way, in any possible way, based on what these guys think of their martial art.
I remember that as being one of the most well-researched books that I had ever, even to this day, owned. I mean, just the number of styles and the history behind it was always really impressive.
Yeah, and you got to remember, this is before there was a huge boom in publishing of stuff on the martial arts. I mean, since then, you know, there are bookstores devoted to this. Back when I did that, book, I mean, my reference list was virtually every martial art book and magazine in existence, and there just wasn't as much information out there as there is now. And I'm happy to say that in all the years since then, I've yet to meet anybody who's really been able to rip the system apart. I mean, and experts, and it's really nice to meet experts. Experts who I meet tell me that I got it right. So,
just out of curiosity, what martial arts styles did you study?
I first studied a little bit of Muay Thai, which was a karate thing. I studied a little bit of Taekwondo, and I studied a little bit of Aikido. So those are the three. Oh, and I was also a fencer. So when I was early in my university days, I was a fencer. So I had some sense of those things.
Yeah, I fenced, and I studied jiu-jitsu, so always good to meet somebody else who fences, and not many of us out there.
Yeah, fencing to me is, you know, one of those things that, you know, you got to do it for a while in order to really figure it out. But once you figure it out, it really makes a difference in how you perceive martial arts.
After Ninjas and Super Spies, it seems like you kind of kick off a couple different East Asian books with Mystic China, and then you've got a Rifts book that deals with China.
Yeah, after Ninjas and Super Spies came Mystic China, and let me tell you how that happened. I don't know if you guys know the story, but here's what happened with Mystic China. So Kevin was planning on doing Villains Unlimited. I think that was the book. And I get a call from Kevin, and he's troubled about something. He says, "Eric, can you come on over?" And I said, "Sure, I'll be over in a little while." So I walk in, and Kevin pulls out the painting, and he puts it up against the wall, and he says, "So, Eric, what do you think?" And I look at the painting, and I say, "Well, it's not what you wanted it to be. When I look at that, I'm thinking Mystic China." And he looks at me, and he says, "Great, do the book." And literally, that's how Mystic China came about. We got a painting that was the cover painting for Mystic China, and it wasn't right for the book we were going to do, and I got assigned the job of doing Mystic China, which was really weird for me because I had never studied anything Chinese. I had strictly been interested in Japanese stuff, Japanese culture, Japanese mythology, samurai, ninja, all that stuff. I was totally solid on all that stuff, especially after Ninjas and Super Spies. I thought the next book I would do might be on the Yakuza or might be a historical thing of historical Japan. You know, I was thinking in those terms, and it had never occurred to me that I would have to do a China book. But I knew enough about it. I mean, when I took this really crazy, difficult class in Asian art history when I was at Wayne State University, and it was this class I took kind of as a challenge. My old girlfriend at the time had aced this class, and I decided that I would take this class, which she said was one of the most difficult classes she'd ever taken, and see if I could ace it. And I did. And part of that class required you, as the final exam, the teacher, the professor, would put slides of different art on the board, and you'd have to be able to tell whether it was Japanese or Chinese. What was the origin? What was the date? What was the period? you know, everything about the picture that went up there, even pictures you had never seen before.
Yeah.
So I knew enough about it to be able to say, okay, I know there's a huge difference between Chinese and Japanese. And I think I've got enough groundwork, so I think I can do this. But the research on that book was more research than I have ever done for anything in my life. And you've already heard I did a lot of research for Recon on the Vietnam War, did a lot of research for Ninjas and Super Spies, and a lot of research for every book I've done. But that one really took the cake. I mean, that took such in-depth research and just pulling out really obscure, bizarre sources to find out, you know, where did this stuff come from? What is this mythology about? What is this about? I mean, this is such a strange thing. And as it happened, I totally fell in love with Chinese stuff. I mean, the Chinese culture, it just blew me away. I had, you know, all my life I had thought that the Japanese was, you know, the better thing, the more fun thing, and that the Chinese was just some the antiquated, weird stuff. But by the time I got done working on Mystic China, I was totally turned around. To me, the Chinese was the real gold mine for role-playing. And I haven't turned back since then. And that experience with Mystic China is what ultimately led to my real-life experiences in China, which we can talk about if you want.
And that seems like a good place to stop the interview. So next week, we'll hear about Eric's adventures in China, and he'll finish up talking about how he got the Amber license and how he wrote the game. He's got some really interesting observations about game design that I really want you all to hear. So come back next time. And when people ask you how you know so much about Eric Wujek, you tell them you heard it as Echoes on the Riffs. The music tonight was provided by the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. This episode of the Echoes from the Rifts podcast is copyrighted Palladium Books Incorporated, all rights reserved. Megaverse, Palladium Books, Rifts, and other titles and names are registered trademarks of Palladium Books Incorporated and are used with their permission. Opinions expressed by the interviewer and the individual interviewed are not those of Palladium Books.